Hejaz leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as the world's biggest anti-terror organization, warning of enemy plots to distort its image. Iran and Saudi Arabia say they are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations to help enhance security and stability of the region. And Palestinians bid farewell to the latest victim of Israeli atrocities after a deadly raid by the regime forces into the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemy is seeking to tarnish the image of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the besieged volunteer force. Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei said the reasons behind the plot against the IRGC and besieged are their attractiveness that makes the enemy worried and agitated. The leader added that the enemy tries to smear the IRGC by resorting to fake news and rumors, as well as different kinds of deception and ploys. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined that the enemy would not like the IRGC to become a role model. The leader described the IRGC as the biggest anti-terrorist organization in the world. He praised the IRGC as a well-equipped, efficient, and independent military body, which has not stopped its work since its establishment around 4 decades ago. The leader made the comments in a meeting with the IRGC commanders. Tehran reiterates its readiness to cooperate with Riyadh in a wide array of issues, including regional security. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amri Abdollahian said both countries agree that previous deals regarding security, commerce, and economy must be implemented. Amri Abdollahian was speaking at a joint press conference with his Saudi counterpart. Prince Faisal bin Farhan said that Riyadh is looking forward to further strengthening relations on the basis of mutual respect. The Saudi Foreign Minister said Riyadh was willing to ensure lasting security in the region through cooperation with Tehran. He said King Salman has officially invited Iran's president to Riyadh. Prince Faisal made a visit to the Islamic Republic in June, just weeks after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to resume diplomatic relations. Two countries severed ties in 2016 following angry protests in Iran over the execution of Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr in the kingdom. Iran and Saudi Arabia have pledged for enhanced regional stability. Fuad Zaidi says only time will tell whether Saudi Arabia can withstand pressure from the U.S. and Israel and maintain good relations with Iran.
I think the Saudi government has realized that confronting Iran is not in line with their national interest. It's really not possible to fight Iran in that manner any longer. And Iran historically has been interested in resolving issues with Saudi Arabia. Iran and Saudi Arabia are neighbors. Neighbors should not be confronting each other. So I think as time passes, you will see these type of exchanges. I think with the visit of Iran's president, the ties will improve. There is a question that needs to be answered. That is whether the Saudis can withstand pressures from the United States and Israel to continue this policy of following their own interests instead of listening to the ill-advised rhetoric of the United States and Israel. Whether they can do that or not, time will tell, but I think so far, so good.
Iran has organized a conference in Tehran to review the effects of sanctions on the access of patients to life-saving medicines. Iranian officials have contradicted U.S. claims, asserting that medical supplies and food items have not been exempted from the sanctions in practice. Saman Khujuri reports.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the U.N. Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this reporter and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia. Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians have held a funeral procession for the victim of the latest Israeli attack on the occupied West Bank. 32-year-old Mustafa Kastoni was fatally shot during a pre-dawn Israeli raid in the city of Jenin. The victim was a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, an armed wing of President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement. The attack also left several people injured, including a female staff of the Palestinian Health Ministry. The assault came a day after the regime's troops raided the flashpoint city of Nablus, injuring dozens of Palestinians. The Israeli violence against Palestinians has been on the rise, with more and more Palestinians falling victim to Tel Aviv's brutalities day by day. At least 210 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories so far this year. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil, says fresh fighting erupted in the city of Jenin after undercover Israeli forces were exposed by Palestinians.
Israeli special undercover units raided the Jenin area in order to occupy the West Bank in order to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons or even to assassinate wanted Palestinians, Palestinian fighters. However, these units were exposed by Palestinian fighters. Exchange of fire erupted. Immediately, the Israeli military sent more troops and Israeli soldiers to Jenin, to the Jenin city, and heavy clashes erupted, according to the Israeli military and according to Palestinians in the Jenin area. These clashes led to the killing of 32-year-old Mustafa al-Kastoni. It seems that Mustafa al-Kastoni was one of the Palestinian fighters, and he was shot in the head, in the chest, and the abdomen, and he succumbed to his injuries, of course. Another Palestinian was wounded during this Israeli military raid to Jenin. The Israeli forces arrested before leaving Jenin area two more Palestinians. One of them is a family member of the Kastoni.
Armenia and Azerbaijan have traded blame for the situation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region during an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
These humanitarian issues clearly need to be resolved with the international community's strong intervention before the negative consequences result in ethnic cleansing of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I shall start by categorically rejecting all the unfounded and groundless allegations on blockade or humanitarian crisis propagated by Armenia against my country.
The 15-member council met as an Azerbaijani blockade of the disputed territory drags into its ninth month. Recently, a former International Criminal Court prosecutor said the blockade may amount to, quote, genocide of the local Armenian population. Meanwhile, a senior UN aid official told the council that the International Committee of the Red Cross must be allowed to resume the delivery of humanitarian relief to Nagorno-Karabakh.
The ICRC is doing everything it can, but as a single organization, it can only cover the most urgent needs. Other impartial humanitarian relief must also be allowed to reach civilians who need it, and a sustainable solution for safe and regular transit of people and goods must be found.
Other Security Council members also addressed the session. Russia said that it will use all diplomatic channels to prevent a humanitarian tragedy, as well as resuming the provision of essential goods to the region. The U.S. called on both sides to meet their obligations under international humanitarian law, while urging Azerbaijan to restore free movement to the corridor. Karabakh is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but is populated mostly by ethnic Armenians. Baku and Yerevan have fought two wars over the region. The latest conflict in 2022 left nearly 300 people dead and displaced more than 7,000. Some sad news from Malaysia, where a light plane has crashed into a residential area, killing at least 10 people. The aircraft was heading to an airport on the outskirts of the capital Kuala Lumpur when it crashed onto an expressway in the central state of Selangor. All 8 passengers on board immediately died. 2 passing motorists on the road were also killed. Civil aviation authorities have not confirmed the casualties yet, but they say that a search and rescue mission is underway. There's a chaotic scene at Germany's Frankfurt airport as intense rainfall turns the runway into a swimming pool. Heavy rain and thunderstorms hit the German city, inundating roads and bringing traffic to a standstill. Video posted on social media showed that large parts of the runway were covered with water. The airport website reported that some 70 flights were canceled due to inclement weather. Thousands of passengers were stranded. On Wednesday, the German Weather Service issued severe weather alerts across the state of Hesse. The death toll from devastating wildfires in the U.S. state of Hawaii rises further as the search operation continues for hundreds more who remain unaccounted for.
So we'll start with where we are in general. 110 individuals have been confirmed deceased. This is unprecedented. No one has ever seen this that is alive today. Not this size, not this number, not this volume, and we're not done.
According to Green, rescue and search teams have covered 38% of the fire-ravaged town of Lahaina in Maui County. He said about 2,000 homes and businesses remain without electricity. Blazes forced harrowing escapes and displaced thousands. Officials have been criticized for failing to issue alerts and their lackluster response to the tragedy. Hawaii's Attorney General has already opened an investigation into the authorities' handling of the wildfires. According to the National Fire Protection Association, the Maui wildfires are the deadliest in the U.S. in more than a century, surpassing the 2018 campfire that erupted in California. The Economic Community of West African States has once again threatened military action against the junta in Niger. A senior ECOWAS official says the community stands ready to intervene militarily if diplomacy fails to restore order. The official said constitutional order will be restored in Niger by all means available. The official was at a meeting of ECOWAS army chiefs in Ghana to discuss the details of a standby force tasked with potential engagement in Niger. The official said a majority of the 15 ECOWAS member states are prepared to participate in the standby force. Niger's military officers deposed President Mohamed Bazoum in late July. They have defied calls from the UN, ECOWAS, and Western powers to reinstate the president. The West is now mulling sanctions against the junta. Nations has warned of impending famine in Sudan as the devastating armed conflict is disrupting agricultural activities in the war-torn country. The international body says the situation is spiraling out of control and that millions of people are facing acute food insecurity and healthcare crisis.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
It's looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid. Things we have seen throughout those 4 months may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. Biden is seeking $40 billion in emergency funds for Ukraine and disaster relief. That total includes $13 billion in military aid to Ukraine, as well as billions of dollars more in funding to replenish a dwindling pot of federal disaster relief, according to two people with direct knowledge of the request. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, the United States' flow of military and economic aid to Ukraine will rise by more than $20 billion if Congress approves a request that the White House made recently. The $20.3 billion, part of a larger $40 billion request, includes $13 billion in military aid for Ukraine in its conflict with Russia and $7.3 billion in economic and humanitarian assistance. It also includes $3.3 billion for infrastructure projects in regional countries impacted by the war. Since the start of the crisis in Eastern Europe in February 2022, the U.S. Congress has authorized $113 billion in overall funding related to Ukraine. If the new package is approved, that total will reach about $137 billion. The wider bill also includes money to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative, about $12 billion for natural disaster recovery in the U.S. and billions of dollars more to protect the U.S. southern border, along with funds to stem drug trafficking. The White House reportedly was expected to include aid to Taiwan to the bill, but that was not included. The $40 billion in funding will be in the form of an emergency supplemental package, a type of spending not limited by the debt ceiling deal reached between the White House and House Republicans in June. Shalonda Young, director of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, in a letter to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, urged swift action on the U.S. commitment to Ukraine. A senior administration official told CNN, "We don't know how much longer this war is going to go on or how much more assistance we might need to support Ukraine. We won't be bashful about going back to Congress beyond the first quarter of next year if we feel like we need to do that." The Biden administration's request came after a poll from CNN found that 55% of Americans are against more spending on the conflict in Eastern Europe. Also, in the CNN poll, 51% said the U.S. already has done enough to help the Eastern European nation, which is not a member of NATO. Partisan cracks are emerging over the continuing funding to Ukraine, with support dropping among Republicans. The aid request sets up a potential battle with Republicans in Congress, some of whom have been skeptical over providing Ukraine any more money. McCarthy has said he doesn't support a blank check for Ukraine. After the debt ceiling deal passed, he said he wasn't prepared to support additional funding for Ukraine, arguing that it would be a violation of the deal. McCarthy said working on a supplemental right now is only blowing up the agreement. That's all about spending more money. So, no, I do not support a supplemental. 70 House Republicans voted in July on an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to strip Ukraine of all American military aid. The measure failed, but revealed substantial opposition. Representative Chip Roy of Texas, a member of the House Freedom Caucus that has often clashed with McCarthy, said, This should be a non-starter for House GOP. It's time to stand up for Americans and against uniparity. There is a difference of opinion between House and Senate leadership on Ukraine funding. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate GOP Leader Mitch McConnell both support continuing aid to Ukraine. McConnell, speaking in Louisville, Kentucky, recently said, "People think, increasingly it appears, that we shouldn't be doing this. Well, let me start by saying we haven't lost a single American in this war. Most of the money that we spend related to Ukraine is actually spent in the U.S. replenishing weapons, more modern weapons. So it's actually employing people here and improving our own military for what may lie ahead." Mick Wallace, a member of the European Parliament from Ireland, wrote, "A lot of politicians and mainstream media are happy to continue supporting and fueling the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Ukraine. These are not the people dying in this stupid war. How much do these people really care about the working-class Ukrainians who are dying?" Also, Canadian journalist Aron Mate wrote, "Biden administration encouraged Ukraine to integrate into NATO and assault Donbas. It refused to seriously address Russia's December 2021 proposals. After the crisis, it blocked a peace deal. It then pushed Ukraine into a counteroffensive it knew had no chance. Then it told Ukraine it won't join NATO anyway. Now it wants another $20.6 billion to prolong the war it provoked." Warren Davidson, a former Army Ranger, wrote, "Again, without a defined mission, how can we ever say mission accomplished? We can't keep sending aid without clear rationale for its intended purpose. And no, as long as it takes is not a sufficient answer." Also, according to Politico, Biden's emergency aid pitch will almost certainly cause additional angst on Capitol Hill, where lawmakers face a tight timeline to avert a government shutdown by September 30. House conservatives have pushed for further cuts to government funding, already jeopardizing the passage of new spending bills before the White House's request for additional cash.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذی أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the war on terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the war on terror today. But was this war on terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, don't you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this. But the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections, and so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq, to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales, $46.5 billion. Gross profit, $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing. Total sales, $68.7 billion. Gross profit, $4 billion. 3. BAE. Total sales, $30.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics. Total sales, $32.7 billion. Gross profit, $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Gross profit, $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brar regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Laocoon. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001, was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq. And famously, Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said, in around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact the list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. It was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy, they would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state, and in particular U.S. companies, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going in. Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important. Iraq has perhaps 10-15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. What were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. U.S. has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many U.S. defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, There were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth, where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.